So glad to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our next guest is Mark Shepherd. He is the founder and president of Restoration Agriculture Development and the CEO of Forest Agriculture Enterprises. He teaches agroforestry and permaculture worldwide, has also written a book. It's called Restoration Agriculture. He runs the New Forest Farm. It's a 106-acre perennial agricultural savanna, and it's located in Biola, Wisconsin. And he's going to tell us about restoration agriculture and what his 20-plus year-long experiment on his land has taught him. And, of course, as we visit with him, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about sustainable agriculture? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Mark Shepherd, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, hi there, Larry. Thanks for inviting me.
I understand you moved from Alaska to Biola, Wisconsin in the 90s to start the farm. Why Wisconsin, and why did you want to start this project?
Well, for one thing, it was for the warm winters. But one of the reasons why I moved down is that I was trained as a forest ecologist, and I homesteaded in Alaska. And when I looked around me at the land in the valley, the settlers basically went out to this beautiful, you know, pristine wilderness area and destroyed it in order to earn their livelihood. And that led me to a study of agriculture. And then that's, you know, long history of literature talking about how annual agriculture is based on human beings eradicating an environment, including the indigenous peoples, plowing up the ground and planting some hard seeds that only grow for a few months and eventually eroding all your soil, polluting the rivers, cutting down all your trees because you need them for warships and spears and chariots and all that, and then starving to death so you take over the next people and so on and so on. And so what I wanted to do is use some of my experience and skills as a restoration ecologist and restore the ecology of a worn-out piece of farmland while simultaneously producing food. It's not a one or the other. We can do both.
So your definition, I mean, what is the definition of restoration agriculture then? It's literally restoring the land?
Yeah, I coined the term, so I guess I get a little leeway as far as the definition is concerned. But it's an intentional combination of restoration ecology, where we go to a place and we upgrade the ecosystem. We go to a rundown farm, a parking lot, a clear cut, a backyard, whatever the case may be, and then restore it to a healthy, fully functioning ecosystem with all of the plant community types that would have been there. Well, how traditionally that's been done recently is you go to a place, you buy it, you apply for grants, and then you preserve it, you put in walking trails, and if it was previously a farm, it no longer provides food for humans. Well, we do it slightly differently. We'll go and we will replace plant community types that have historically been there, but we'll cherry pick and we'll heavily weight the system with all of the edibles. An example that I use the most, especially in the upper Midwest, and it's what the Wisconsin farm is based on, is the oak savanna. And if we can imagine all of these different wild plants, and you see them all around you, you may not be able to identify them, but they're all around us in Wisconsin. The taller trees were fagaceae in many cases, which were oak, chestnut, or beech. An understory of malus and prunus, which are apples, cherries, or hawthorns thrown in there as well. Shrubs of plum and hazelnut, shade-tolerant plants of currants and gooseberries. Vines such as grapes crawling all over the thing. Raspberries, blackberries, green grass growing all around, animals all over the place, and fungi that decomposes leaves, branches, twigs, roots, grows in the soil. Everything that I just listed right there is edible. And so what we can do is we can design an ecosystem that's 100% edible from some animals eating grass, laying eggs, all the way to mushrooms eating logs. I just had a combed tooth mushroom the other day for breakfast that was growing in a rotten beech log. It was fabulous.
It sounds wonderful, Mark. But can you make it pay? I mean, can you?
Yeah, that's actually the tricky part right there. Is you have to start any piece of land, no matter where you are in the world, is at a certain what's called an ecological stage of succession. Ecosystems change. If you leave a parking lot alone, eventually lichens and mosses will grow on it, and grasses in the cracks in the sidewalk, and eventually raspberries and so on. And that system will change through time. Sometimes it takes thousands of years to develop a full, complete ecosystem. We can go in and we can design a system where our woody species are in a row. We can still do our agricultural crops, even corn and beans if you want, in between, in the alleys in between. And that's an agroforestry technique called alley cropping. And so the trick is to figure out how to make it cash flow in the early years while your perennials take time to mature. And in my case, I actually did grow corn and beans for a few years in the earliest years, and eventually settled in growing produce, organic produce, and I was one of the earlier members of the Organic Valley Cooperative in Lafarge.
Well, and I went online to your website and took a look at the farm itself. It looks beautiful.
That's another thing about it is they're very beautiful properties. And most of the people that we are encountering these days are doing restoration agriculture in combination, to beef farming and many times to keep it in agricultural taxes, but also to really improve the asset value of the property. Instead of just buying a cornfield and holding it for 10 years and then selling it and making, 10%, whatever it is, you can buy it, do the restoration agriculture process, and get an additional value add, because when you sell it, it looks like a park. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is indeed. Mark Shepherd, our guest today, great to have him with us. If you want to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. In your mind, what are the biggest issues with conventional agriculture right now?
I think one of the biggest issues with conventional agriculture right now is people, and I'm going to stick my neck out a little bit because I'm not afraid to, is that people are afraid to admit that the system is broken. You look around us in the state of Wisconsin, all of the corn and all the beans is growing all over the place everywhere. That is one of the largest examples of the welfare state that the human race has ever known. Without all of the different programs and grants and cost share programs and cheap fuel, fossil fuel, and wars in the Middle East to keep bringing that fossil fuel and mega huge industries to continue to wash the soil away, people aren't willing to talk about that often enough. Whereas if you look at the brush and the ditches on the side of the road, that has been growing and has been growing food for as long as there's been a ditch on the side of the road. And it's been doing it with zero inputs whatsoever. People who go out and collect food on the side of the road, they're foragers. And I'm not saying that foragers are wrong or that we all should go to a life of foraging. But what we can do is we can design our farms and produce large-scale wholesale quantities, mass-market quantities of food, carbohydrates, proteins, and oils. If we design our farms after the ditches on the side of the road, so why those plants grow on the side of the road with all kinds of abuse and total neglect, that's the secret right there. And they do it without fossil fuel inputs, they do it without federal subsidies, and they do it without borrowing.
Jenny in Brookfield has a question. Jenny, hi.
Hi, I'm calling because I'm wondering, how small of a property would you typically do this on? We own 2 acres in the outside of Milwaukee area. And it's all grass, and we'd love to restore it to some more natural stuff. So how small would we want to consider that for, and where would we start?
Well, one of the things, Jenny, that I have, if you look at an aerial photograph of New Forest Farm, you'll see a There's a bunch of circles. I was going to say you'll see a circle, but this is one circle. It's a 20-foot diameter circle that is a collection of the who's who of all those species that I just listed of the oak savanna, you know, food species. So if you did a 20-foot circle and you used bark mulch under that and you had to put black plastic edging because the landscape code in your municipality says that you have to, that's fine. One of the issues that you have with a smaller system is the fact that you may be creating an oasis where if you're, you know, living in a suburban area, everybody has chem lawn, taking care of all their pests and diseases. Well, the pests and diseases want someplace to go, so they go to your place. So you won't have the strength of ecological processes working in your favor because you don't have large enough populations to deal with that. One of the things that you won't have in a backyard example also would be enough of a quantity to have it be economically worthwhile for you to harvest something and sell it in order to pay your bills. However, it'll work. I'm where I'm sitting right now, I'm looking at literally the ditch on the side of the road, and I see strawberries on the ground with blueberries over the top of it, service berries coming out of it, hazelnuts on the bank behind it, and oak trees coming out on the side, and a walnut growing up over the top of it. It's right there. It's just like in a 10-foot spot right in front of me. I didn't go looking for this.
Well, you know, I hope you will stay with us. Jenny and Mark Shepherd will be, of course, staying with us right up until 12:30 today. We can continue that discussion. We got some other great calls that we'll get to as well right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking today with Mark Shepherd. He founded the New Forest Farm in Biola, Wisconsin with his wife, Jen, in 1994. Since then, it's grown to 106 acres, which they have converted from worn-out row crop farmland to perennial, sustainable agricultural operation. He's written books, taught permaculture and agroforestry classes, and is the founder of Forest Agriculture Enterprises. So as we visit with him, what questions do you have about his work or about restoration agriculture? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Steve in Mount Pleasant has something kind of relates maybe to Jenny from Brookfield. But Steve, what's on your mind?
I have 3/4 acre zone 5B. There's some mature walnuts, a little wild plum, but for 30 some years, it's been overgrown with buckthorn. It's heavy, expansive clay, floods in the spring. Ginseng and goldenrod will not take in this soil. There's very little leaf litter because of the buckthorn. Some of these buckthorns are 8 inches diameter. I'd like to keep it organic. Any ideas on what I can do? I have hundreds of yards of wood chips available to me.
All right. Well, that's a classic example of a beautiful black walnut river bottoms environment. And so that's a different plant community type altogether. You already know, you know, mentioned the black walnut and wild plum. Those are two species in that particular plant community. Also included in there would be grape, raspberry, and then typically grasses would be underneath, and fire would be a big part of that system. It's probably, you know, not all that likely that, you know, fire is going to come back naturally on its own, and you don't necessarily have to get involved with fire. But you have a resource with the buckthorn, believe it or not. You know, that can be, it can be pulled and burned, it can be pulled and chipped. And then this is where doing it as restoration agriculture is important, is because there is going to be work involved. You'll have to have some kind of ecological disturbance, you know, fire or labor, to go in there and remove the undesirable species. And if you have enough buckthorn, you can go ahead and chip it. And one of the most ubiquitous mushrooms for consuming wood chips that's edible are the wine cap stropharia. Also fairly decent on buckthorn is oyster mushrooms. And where I like to get my mushroom spawn from is from Field and Forest products up in Peshtigo. And you could probably have who knows how many thousands of pounds of mushrooms coming out of that and get to be known as the Mushroom Walnut Man or whoever you are. One of the things that we also want to include in any system that has walnut that's there, remember, don't grow eggplant and potatoes and peppers because they're not compatible with the walnut. Think about climate change and assisted migration of species. There are other members of the walnut family that like similar conditions that you might want to use there that may not do so well right off the bat in the early years, but over time may do better than the black walnut. And I'm thinking specifically of pecan and the Persian walnut. And then in the plant community types, as with the pecan, you can plant passion fruit, you can plant persimmon. I haven't had a lot of luck with persimmon because they keep freezing off. The last of my persimmons went a couple years ago, but you're a little bit warmer than me still, and so that's possible that they would do quite well in there. And those are all just a little bit on the warmer side. And as climate changes or doesn't change, you know, we'll find out if those are the species for that place. And another edible to throw in that mix is pawpaw. It's becoming an increasingly popular fruit.
So lots of good tips there. By the way, you have people come to your farm, or you have tours that people can take of your farm to see the operation and talk to you.
Correct. You know, there are several during the year. What's interesting is because it's a perennial system, I don't, believe it or not, it's really not all that much work during the course of the year. However, when, you know, this particular, when it's asparagus season, I'm doing nothing but asparagus, period. That's all I'm doing. If it's hazelnut season, I'm doing nothing but hazelnuts. If it's chestnut season, nothing but chestnuts. But in between, I've got plenty of time to take people out on tours. And you'd have to go to the Restoration Ag website or the New Forest Farm website to schedule for one of those.
It's New Forest Farm. Yeah, I typed that in and went to it and got right there. So, Stephen, thank you so much. Taylor in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Taylor.
Mark, how's it going?
Hi there, Taylor. I suspected it was you.
Big fan. Love your books. Love your new online course. I want you to expand on what you've seen as the importance of perennial plantings and the diversity of having warm and cool season annuals instead of what we're seeing right now, where all the warm season annuals are getting taken off and we're seeing, you know, a really good fall for cool season growth. Like, I'm looking at possibly grazing all through December with how everything's going. How have you seen that help New Forest Farm?
Well, with the perennial system in place, I have the opportunity as a farm operator, I have the opportunity to be seasonally opportunistic. And if it's a good season for one crop, I can immediately shift to that because it's a good crop and forget about this other one that wasn't doing so well. Whereas if I had planted, you know, crop number A and it's not doing all that well and that's the only crop that I planted, I'm fully invested in that and I do everything I can, which means more expenses in order to get a good crop out of that. Whereas me, it's like, hey, if crop A is not doing good but crop B is, I immediately shift to go in that particular direction. Another thing that ends up happening is the system that we want to see through time. Many of our folks, and Taylor is one of them, who are developing restoration agriculture systems, are also thinking of specific wildlife habitat enhancements. And specifically, white-tailed deer and turkeys just thrive in the oak savanna biome. And acorns have a habit of masting, like every 5 or 10 years, they'll drop a huge load of nuts, but nothing in between. Whereas chestnuts, they produce every single year, and hazelnuts every single year. And so if you want to see deer and turkey populations boom, those are two crops for you. And you don't have to, quote unquote, worry about deer damage to the crop, because there's enough for all of us if we design a system that has enough in place. If you want to go ahead and harvest every last chestnut, more power to you. But there are other values that we can accent beside just, you know, the agricultural production.
Taylor, thank you so much. You know, kind of to go along with Taylor, Meg emailed, 10 years ago, she and her husband visited your farm, Mark, near Viola, and it was a, kind of the beginning of a journey that's led them to begin at the age of 70-plus, regenerate their 115 acres of prime farmland in southern Minnesota from growing corn and soybeans to grazing grass-fed animals and then to more diversified crops like elderberries and hazelnuts. They're part of a group called Climate Land Leaders and are heartened by the other 35 farmers in this group who are trying to restore the land, build community, and combat climate change.
What I find is amazing, too, is they started when they were so young, you know? It's like, that is the true definition of wisdom, is someone who plants trees under the shade of which, you know, they will never sit. So one of the things that I would want to do with their system, because they mentioned the elderberry and the hazelnut and the grazing, I would want to go ahead and put some oak in there. Whatever the oak is, it's the most appropriate for their region, white oak or red oak. I'm not sure exactly where they are. And then 20 or 30 years from now, they have these wide-spaced, big, huge, open-grown white oak over these grassy pastures, and then throw in the wildflower mix while you're at it.
Sounds wonderful. Meg, thanks for that email. You can join in, too, by the way, 800-642-1234. Or email to ideas@wpr.org. John in Madison up next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Kind of an odd question. I was wondering if any larger farms or larger programs would be hiring people or doing apprenticeships for work like this. I really feel really strongly about this, but it seems like the entry level of this is starting your own small scale thing, and I was wondering if there's a way to kind of learn on the job from someone wiser.
Well, there actually are, and there will be a lot more of it happening a lot faster right now. There are at least two enterprises that I'm involved with right now that aren't yet at startup phase, but if you start hounding them now and they know you're waiting in the wings and you have appropriate educational background. One is the Great Plains Initiative, and the other one is Cranmore Advisors. And Cranmore, I think, is spelled C-R-A-N-N-M-O-R. And both of those operations have fairly large projects that they've started and will be involving dozens and dozens of people.
So the first one was, again, Great, what was it?
Great Plains Regeneration.
Great Plains Regeneration. Okay. And
so Great Plains Regeneration would be based in probably Nebraska-ish area, but Nebraska, Kansas. And then Cranmore right now is focusing in upstate New York.
Upstate New York. And I bet if you go online and type that into Google, you're going to get some information.
You'll be able to find either of them, correct.
All right. There you go, John. Thank you so much. Let's go to Val in Green Bay. Hi, Val.
Hi. Hello, can you hear me? I have two questions, actually. So we have a 240-acre farm up near Green Bay. It's Full Circle Farm. And we do grass-fed organic beef. And we are doing hazelnuts, currants, berries, et cetera, in the margins of the farm. And my first question is, how are we going to we really haven't commercialized those crops, but we really need to because, you know, the third leg of sustainability is economic, and we need to be economically sustainable on the farm. And then the other question I have is, have you addressed or written anything about, you know, the idea of vegetarianism and we want to eat more burgers made out of peas and oats and other annual crops, and that's not doing us grass-fed farmers any favors because then we're, again, plowing and planting. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll kind of work backwards with those questions because I sometimes have a hard time remembering more than one thing. But as far as a vegetarianism, veganism, as an ecologist, from the ecological perspective, if I go out and I'm looking right now at this really beautiful forested hillside, if I go out there, cut all those trees down, you know, to get rid of them, however, plow up all the ground to grow beans and peas to make, you know, plant-based protein burgers, that is ecologically harmful. If, however, I go ahead and I design a system that has chestnuts and hazelnuts and elderberries and currants and grapes, I now replant a full, complete ecology, and I use cattle as the grass man, the land managers. They're mowing the weeds for me, and I have the fertilizer circulating the nutrients. I don't have to eat those animals. They are useful. There's no place on planet Earth right now that has zero animals involved. This is an animal-based planet. I can eat chestnuts and hazelnuts and acorns and beechnuts and all of these different other foods right now. We don't need to even breed perennial wheat in order to make bread. We have all of the raw materials necessary for us to have a complete vegetarian diet while still improving the ecology of the landscape around us.
And the first part of the question had to do with how do you sort of monetize those?
Yeah. So here's part of the interesting thing that it's like a cart before the horse, and it's been, you know, the biggest challenge that we've had, especially in the upper Midwest, with any kind of crop other than the commodities that are already, you know, in the front door and blocking the way for everybody else. There's places, let's take Great Plains Regeneration. They can't get to a rail terminal with certain grains because there's too long of a waiting line between corn and beans, and they won't let you store them there anyways. So they force you to grow corn and beans, otherwise they don't give you access to the market. So that's not fair. So legal work has to happen that way. And or we go ahead and we create our own alternative marketing system. You know, it was fortuitous that I ended up in Lafarge, Wisconsin, as, you know, Organic Valley was just getting started. And I got to experience what it was like when farmers actually get together, pool their resources, pool their crop together, and get it to market via a channel that never existed before. And so in the upper Midwest, with hazelnuts specifically, we're also attempting that with the American Hazelnut Company. You can look them up online as well. It's a farmer-owned hazelnut marketing company. And the problem is, in order to pay for the equipment that we need for processing of those nuts, we need enough nuts. No one's going to invest in the equipment if there's no nuts to process. Well, who's going to plant enough nuts to require a processor unless there's a processor? And so we need to do both at the same time, which either means large investors get involved or that means more individuals get involved. You know, we may have our preferences as to what we would rather see. Personally, I would rather see way more smallholders get involved and have more of an Organic Valley type model with 2,000 plus individual members that actually own the company instead of having a, you know, a Jeff Bezos owned and operated, you know, linear patriarchal, you know, top down hierarchy where he owns absolutely everything and we're just growing hazelnuts for him.
So we
have to get up to scale. We have to aggregate. We have to grow enough. The problem is not the markets. There's enough markets for hazelnuts. You know, we can't grow enough hazelnuts to satisfy the market at current market demand right now. We just need to grow enough in order to justify the processing equipment.
So, Val, does that help?
It does. We do have hazelnuts, but we're in Green Bay, and I know that co-op is more the western side of the state into Minnesota. So it's still access to market by the time we ship our nuts over. Even if we would have harvesting equipment, we're in a tight spot to make any income off of that.
Yeah.
So that's our issue.
Currently right now, the American Hazelnut Company groups, they are in regional pools. And right now, it's as a matter of fact, last time I was on Larry Mueller's show was with Jason Fishbach, where we were talking specifically about hazelnuts. Most of the primary processing happens over in Ashland. And so all you need is enough people in your area to justify somebody with a truck and a trailer to haul all your product over to Ashland. And then it's up to the folks in Ashland to figure out how to get it down to Gay's Mills, where it's processed into the oils and the flour and snack mix. And just as far as here's a radical difference between restoration agriculture and what I'll call horticulture or orcharding. One of the problems that I see right now with people's perspective on hazelnut as a specific is they want hazelnuts to perform and pay for all of the bills all by themselves in a bastardized, stripped-down system. They want to yank hazelnuts out of the ecological context of the world, plant them in a field all by themselves with herbicide and mulch and irrigation and spray this and spray that, and then they expect that to pay all your bills, and they throw up their hands and they say, oh, gee, there aren't any varieties that pay the bills. Well, it's because that way of growing hazelnuts is the wrong way of growing hazelnuts. The way that you grow hazelnuts cost-effectively is the way that nature has been growing hazelnuts since the beginning of time, whether it was 6,000 years ago or 95 million years ago. Hazelnuts grow in mixed polycultures with other plants, with support organisms, with fungi, with squirrels. They are part of a system. Then if you go and you have people who harvest by hand, there's this beautiful concept called the low-hanging fruit. And you just strip the hazelnuts that you can grab as fast as you can and throw them into buckets. This year, we got our hazelnuts picked for 75 cents a pound. The buying price for American Hazelnut Company is like $1.30, $1.35 this year. It's 50 cents a pound profit. Show me any corn farmer making 50 cents a pound profit on their corn. It's not happening. So we can do it all by hand. You just can't grow it the way with all those inputs. Because once you take anything out of its natural context, you're responsible for the pest control. You're responsible for the disease control. You're responsible for the fertility. You're responsible for the light, for all these other things that nature provides for the plants when they're grown as ecological communities. And that's systems, the kind of systems that restoration agriculture designs.
Val, thank you so much for calling. Pam in Green Bay emailed. She's reading Overstory by Richard Powers. It's about the type of plant-animal relationships that you're speaking about. And the book addresses the value of trees, especially the old sentinel trees in the northwest of the U.S. and their vital relationship to fungi and mosses and other plants and critters.
And no matter where you go around the world, there are families of plants that belong together, that support one another, that will supply human beings with all their needs. And so what we end up happening is we'll end up having local regionalized markets that are very specific to a very specific place.
Yeah, as she concludes, we all need more understanding of the relationship in nature and the role of we as humans can play in supporting all of this. And I tell you what, Mark, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I hope people go to your website, New Forest Farm, type that in, and learn more about what you're doing. But I appreciate you being back with us to talk about your farm. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Bye-bye, Larry.
Mark Shepard, founder of New Forest Farm, located in Viola, Wisconsin. He's also the author of several books, including Water for Any Farm and Restoration Agriculture. So those are a couple of books by Mark Shepard that you could grab hold of and read and learn some more about his work. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, we'll talk home improvement with Chad Spate on a variety of topics to keep in mind before we head into winter. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.